Want to learn more about the unknown ladies of architecture? Then I recommend you listen to She Builds Podcast, where we tell the stories of remarkable women who have shaped the design and construction industries.
Hi, I'm Jessica.
I'm Nurjiti.
And I'm Lizzie.
After we graduated from Syracuse University School of Architecture, we set out to learn and share the untold stories of women that traditional school curriculum left out.
One day, there's an announcement on campus that women had been seen wearing, quote, inappropriate clothing. Gasp.
What the heck does that mean?
Yeah, so it turns out that Ruth and her fellow classmates were these women. They had field classes where they're doing welding, forging, and foundry work, and obviously they have to wear jeans to those classes instead of, like, dresses or whatever else.
While Gertie was in school, she wasn't just going to classes, trying to stay alive like some of us. I know that was me in school, just taking it day by day.
Yes.
But not Gertie. She became the president of EVIGOL, an honorary association of Cornell women architects.
Of course she did.
These are stories not taught in schools. Women who've molded the world of architecture, construction, and development for over a century.
From Jane Jacobs to Ray Eames, She Builds Podcast explores the legacies of trailblazers. Subscribe now on your favorite podcast platform.
Let's fill the gaps in history together. All you have to do is follow the link in the show notes and subscribe and be part of a movement to expand industry narratives.
The primary means of circulation of the school was a series of ramps and not the stairs. And it was just a 3 or 4 story school, which meant that all of these kids had to be in the same public space, right, of the ramp. So that gave my son a lot of visibility and made him feel included.
Welcome to Tangible Remnants. I'm Nikita Reed, and this is my show where I explore the interconnectedness of architecture, preservation, sustainability, race, and gender. I'm excited that you're here. So let's get into it.
Welcome back. This week, I'm talking with Ganesh Nayak of Metier Inc. It was an interesting conversation where we discussed the intersection of sustainability and accessibility in the built environment. Ganesh shares his journey from being an architect to starting his own consultancy focused on sustainability and accessibility. We touch on the challenges of retrofitting historic buildings and the need for architects to go beyond compliance with accessibility codes. He also shares some of his personal story of caring for his son and emphasizes the importance of designing for disabilities and creating inclusive spaces. And one of my favorite parts of this episode is that we touch on the power of well-designed spaces to promote equity. Head over to our Instagram page at Tangible Remnants to see photos that highlight some of the items that Ganesh and I talk about today. And once there, be sure to click on our bio to get access to the Linktree site that will direct you to a number of different resources, from funding opportunities to upcoming conferences where I'll be speaking, and there's even a link for you to sign up for our newsletter. One of the reasons I was super excited to do this interview was because Ganesh is one of my favorite people to run into at conferences. He has such an interesting background, so listen to his bio and you'll see what I mean. Ganesh Nayak, AIA, and NOMA, founded Metier Inc. in Atlanta, Georgia, where he consults on sustainable design and accessibility. Growing up in India, he did his undergraduate studies in architecture before coming to the U.S. and getting a graduate degree at Kansas State University. He's worked in architecture in St. Paul, Minnesota, and Wichita, Kansas, before moving to Atlanta, Georgia. And he has published, taught, and presented extensively on architecture, sustainability, and accessibility. He and his wife, Sitara, are fully involved in the daily care of their young adult son who has developmental disabilities. And Ganesh brings his personal experience and voice to bear on issues of equity, design, and advocacy for disability. He is the current chair of the USGBC's Equity Working Group for LEED Version 5, and he served as the chair of Georgia State's Advisory Panel for Special Education and on the Kansas Governor's Council for Developmental Disabilities as a parent. He's also a member of the AIA Committee on the Environment's Leadership Group, Coat, and he serves as a secretary on the board of AIA Georgia. So he's using his voice and platform to really advocate and raise awareness for issues that sometimes people don't see. Well, I'm super excited for you to hear this episode. So without further ado, I hope you enjoy this conversation between me and Ganesh Nayak. I am super excited to have Ganesh on the show today. And so welcome. Thank you for taking some time.
Oh, thank you so much, Nikita, for having me on the show here.
Of course. And so I remember when we ran into each other at a couple different conferences when we first met. So we met at NOMA and then again at AIA at some of the Committee on the Environment things. So I remember being like, oh, we definitely have some kindred spirits and some overlapping. And then I remember going to your NOMA presentation where you're talking about a lot of sustainability and the overlap of just so many things. And so before I start rambling too much, I would love for you to introduce yourself.
Sure. Hi, my name is Ganesh Nayak. I'm an architect in the Atlanta area, but I was an architect. Now I consult with architects on sustainability and accessibility. So I started my own consultancy about 10 years ago. And before that, I was working in the corporate field as an architect. I did my undergraduate degree in architecture in India and came to the United States after working. Actually, I didn't know, Nikita, that you know that I was working for a few months, maybe about 6 or 7 months in historic preservation in India before I came here. So,
I did not know that. That's awesome.
Yeah. Anyway, then I came here for my grad studies at Kansas State University and was always interested in sustainability. But that kind of took a back seat when I got into grad school and subsequent entry into the profession for about maybe a decade. But then after that, I got right back in with LEED, and I had the good fortune of working on a few LEED projects, and so that gave me the confidence to establish my own consultancy because of personal circumstance that, you know, my son has disabilities, and as he was growing, the corporate setup just wouldn't cut it to be on his schedule for taking him to therapies and all of that, you know. As he was growing up, his needs were getting more and more, which required both my wife's and I, my presence. And I was traveling quite a bit. So I said, it's time to kind of change course.
I'm glad that you made that decision. And so I love that your consultancy combines sustainability and accessibility. When did you see that there was a need to be able to combine both of those together?
Well, actually, I started off as consulting on sustainability. And about 3 years back, I said, well, you know, I'm kind of living the life, so to speak. I mean, as close to disability as I can get, because taking care of my son day in and day out as his primary caregiver and navigating spaces. So that gave me a pretty good idea of what it means to have good accessible architecture. So that's how I got into consulting for accessibility. Basically, you know, I do ADA consulting, but for the past 5 or 6 years, I've always been talking a lot about how we need to go much, much beyond the ADA and make accessibility as integral to the design itself and not as an afterthought.
Yeah, absolutely. What are some of the things that you've noticed in terms of there being a mismatch between the environment and the needs needed for humans needing to use the space, or even some of the challenges that you've seen?
Oh, all the time, because many a time I find that the spaces which are the dimensions and the spaces which are managed by the ADA are not enough, actually. Sometimes the turning radius is not enough in bathrooms. And sometimes bathrooms, well, in my case, since my son has developmental disabilities and needs help with every function, every activity, you know, we are his caregiver, right? So some of the spaces are just not large enough for him and a caregiver. So those are some of those issues which we come across a lot in the buildings. And that's many a time, you know, when we have to change him, it's been a while, but I remember going to Disney 10 years ago. And he loved those rides and all of that. But we had to change him. We went to the family restroom, and unfortunately, there was no changing table. So we had to make do and had to, you know, put him on the floor. So there's a lack of dignity which which we encounter in a number of cases.
Yeah, I've been seeing and learning more about the need for adult changing tables
yes.
in a lot of public yeah. spaces and all that.
I keep advocating for that, yes.
Yes, yes. And I have some colleagues at Quinn Evans as well who've been researching this, particularly with a lot of the museum work that we do with the Smithsonian. But it's things like that that sometimes architects and people who don't need that function don't think about, because it's one of those things where, oh, well, it wasn't necessarily explicitly said in the AIDA or in certain codes, so it's kind of missed. So it's like being able to give more voice to the lived experience of people who have these needs, I think is fantastic.
Yes, absolutely. The need to go beyond looking at the ADA is just a compliance thing, a checklist that we have to check off of. That's something which we as architects, we need to absolutely, you know, shed that attitude. And we have to kind of imagine ourselves, I think, as how a disabled person would navigate our spaces and design for that.
Yeah, absolutely. And I know one of the things that, particularly working with historic buildings, is something where being able to retrofit historic buildings to be able to accommodate more accessibility and be more inclusive is something that also comes up a lot. I know that's something that we're still learning and working through, but what's been your experience in kind of working on any of those kind of projects or consulting or advising on any of those kind of projects?
Yeah, well, I haven't really consulted on the historic preservation project per se. One of the issues about the historic preservation projects and, of course, existing buildings and adaptive reuse, which, of course, is one of our main tools we have to reverse or mitigate the climate change. You know, it's one of our main strategies for decarbonization is to use existing buildings, and it's coming more and more into the foreground, and rightly so. But I do worry sometimes that accessibility is kind of given the short shrift, because the threshold for the ADA is a little lower than in existing buildings than for a new construction. So that's something which we need to be mindful of. I would love for architects in the space to not take the path of least resistance and just, you know, do whatever.
Right. Don't just take the exemption because it's, oh, it's exactly. a historic building. Let's just not worry about letting people get into it. Like, let's really focus on how do we make our buildings more equitable and accessible to everyone who needs to come into it. Yeah.
That's the thing about the code, is that we are always looking for exemptions. And many a time it is valid, because sometimes the code is too stringent or it doesn't make sense or logical sense. So that's it's fine to look for exemptions to make it more logical. But sometimes we take exemptions that kind of might alter the experience of someone else in the building. So that's something which we need to be cautious about, I think.
Yeah, absolutely. That's such a good point. And I think particularly as we're moving into this space of trying to decarbonize our buildings, focus more on net zero building reuse, and really focusing on climate action, it's important that we don't forget about climate justice as well. So not just accessibility in buildings, but then also what are we doing and how are we achieving more of those climate justice roles, particularly with lower income communities bearing more of the burden of pollution and all of that. So how we're thinking about it more global as opposed to just at our individual building scale.
Yes, absolutely. And it brings up a very good point about how we are now seeing, we have to see buildings as much in a much more holistic sense, which incorporates, previously it used to be like a little siloed and insular, where we used to treat sustainability as separate from the design itself. And we just kind of, you know, make it, utilize some tools of to make it more energy efficient and all of that, and then make it sustainable in that sense. But it is still kind of exterior to that. So now we have expanded the definition of sustainability to include equity. And I think that's an extremely important thing to do. And we recognize that it's not only climate action, but climate justice too. So, and they are pretty much, I mean, they are the same thing, but they are not too. Because I think when we bring climate equity and justice, we are looking at the historic wrongs which have been done, and we're trying to remedy them. And when we look at that aspect, we have to look at it differently than climate action itself.
Yeah, absolutely. And I know that you're just such a great presenter, and you've been great at speaking at different conferences and really helping people understand and kind of reframe some of the, I'll say misconceptions that people might have about sustainability or around climate action and all these things. Maybe what's some of the pushback that you get, if any, that you can think of in terms of people either being surprised, like, oh, I hadn't thought of it that way, or just being resistant to really embracing some changes?
I don't really get pushback as such. I mean, there's always that, yes, I hadn't thought of that. There are lots of those type of moments. But I really don't know whether they take it all through, take it back to the work or not. That's important, right? I mean, it's important to do the work. It's important to do substantial work, right? To substantiate on those aspects. That's something which, but some of the challenges, and of course, I mean, all of these challenges come down to budgets, correct? But my point, which I always try to make, is we have to start at a much higher bar and then kind of negotiate down to where it meets the budget or what we can do in the building. But if we start at a much lower bar, then it really, I think it's our attitudes that we have to change, you know, which then we are really not doing anything much for equity. Yeah, it's so important to bring that into buildings.
Yeah. And I know that you're also really heavily involved with the Committee on the Environment. And I know that's something that's kind of been changing a little bit in terms of the reframing of it. Because as you mentioned, sustainability used to be seen as this thing that was separate from design and was an add-on and this other thing that had to happen on top of design. But I know there's been some conversations to try and pivot that so that it's no longer the sustainable projects are in their own category for COAT awards or COAT Top 10 awards, and then the design awards are something different. Now there really is an effort to try and bring the framework for design excellence and all of the tools of sustainability more heavily into the awards. I guess, can you talk a little bit about the work you've been doing with Community on the Environment?
Yeah, sure. So I was fortunate to be selected to join the Committee on the Environment, and I've finished 2 years of my three-year term. This year, I co-chaired the Climate Action, Climate Justice Subcommittee on the Environment. And so we're doing some, we're going to do some exciting work. We are going to get an outside consultant to work on a resource which pulls out good examples of climate action and climate justice and community engagement and all of that. So that resource would be extremely useful for architects to enable climate justice through their work. So that's something which we are going to hopefully roll out in the next about 6 or 7 months. So that's going to be really interesting, and it's going to add to that that really useful slate of equity guides which the AIA has. I'm excited about that.
So, yeah.
I've mentioned it to my family, but in terms of telling people like, oh yeah, we're doing this, I'm looking for projects, you got anything? Yeah. I'm not there yet because it scares the shit out of me.
Dreaming of launching your own architecture firm? Well, buckle up for a wild ride with Emerging, the podcast that shares what it's really like to start an architecture firm.
Where do we begin? We don't even know what type of business to formalize as. Is it an LLC? Is it an LLP? Like, how are taxes? I mean, the list is astronomical.
Season 1 featured founders Jeffrey, Lexi, and Chris, owners of Level Studio Architecture, are your fearless guides on this unfiltered journey from napkin sketches to a thriving studio.
One evening, stumbled into one last dive, we sat at the bar and pondered our postgraduate futures. Amidst the conversation, a napkin became the canvas for our aspirations, sketching plans and milestones, sealing our heartfelt commitment and shared dreams.
In drawing down dreams on a napkin collectively, that then, you know, in your head, you've rooted like, oh, I'm connected to these people, like, long term.
The process of starting an architecture practice brims with excitement and challenges, demanding meticulous planning, flawless execution, and unyielding resilience.
I kind of hate the term because it's so overly used, but I think everybody knows imposter syndrome. And I think it's so real to this day. I don't know if it's with everybody, but with me, I'm always questioning, like, us, can we do this? Are we ready to do this? Are we prepared? Can we do it?
Did we just decide a name?
We did it, guys.
Oh my
God. One that
God.
Came out of nowhere.
Woo!
It came out of nowhere. I liked it. I saw it.
Ready to turn your aspirations into reality? Follow the link in the show notes to subscribe to Emerging and chart your own path to architectural success.
Hey, designers and curious minds. Ever wondered about the stories hiding within your building's walls? I'm Carrie Seaburn, structural engineer and host of Unstruct, the podcast that decodes and simplifies major concepts of structural design. Behind the math and physics, structural engineering simply predicts building behavior. Join me as we simplify the complex, making structural design accessible to everyone.
Nowadays, instead of measuring it via cost, we're saying, well, what about carbon, you know? We've got two levers now that we can, if an architect has an inefficient design, we can hit them with two levers, if you like.
The official casualty figure is 55,000. Everybody I talked to told me that the actual figure is at least three times as much. And I believe that. I mean, seeing what I saw, Turkish codes are good, and they have been improving, but compliance was completely lacking.
Fluent in steel, concrete, masonry, and timber design, I'll bring you leading engineers to dissect the tales behind their building structure. Whether you're an architect, contractor, engineer, or just love a good story, this podcast is for you.
Yeah, beam penetrations. That's a fun topic on this project.
Follow the link in the show notes to subscribe to Unstruct. From within your walls, hear the story behind how your building stands today.
Yeah. I remember at the AIA conference, so the COAT forum was one of the things that was one of my favorite sessions to go to and kind of just be in the room at one of the tables talking with other professionals who were, you know, curious about certain different things, the different prompts that were included on the screen. So that was a really great session that I was really glad to be like, oh yes, Ganesh is here and they're leading it. Yeah, COAT, it was such a great session. So I'm glad you all put
that really
together.
Yeah, it really was. Yeah, well, and we always love that the COAT open sessions because there's so much of enthusiasm and so many people come to it and there's so much energy in the room and there's a lot of good takeaways from that. So I love that, yeah.
Yes, yeah. Absolutely. And so then I guess in terms of, I guess we'll pivot back to some of the accessibility conversation. I know that we've talked a little bit about physical disabilities. Did you also want to talk any about invisible disabilities as well?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. So when we talk about physical, I mean, when you talk about accessibility, of course, we have to make sure that it's not just visible disabilities, but also invisible disabilities, because we tend to look at visible disabilities much more because of the visual state of the altered body in space, right? But many a time, lots of people have disabilities which are invisible, such as hearing loss and even visually impaired and other learning disabilities too. And of course, the neurodivergent spectrum. So we have to design for all of that or consider that in design. And And there's a lot of work which is kind of happening in the past 3 or 4 years of how to better design spaces which cater to to neurodivergent populations. I think we absolutely have to consider all of that in design. Yeah, that's something which we really don't do much, but there's something which I've been kind of keep pushing for. In my work to look at all the entire spectrum of ability or disability, what do we call it? Yeah,
that's super helpful. And yeah. It's like, it's so important because a lot of times it is the things that we can see or the things that are top of mind are often the ones that we'll focus on, as opposed to sometimes doing more of our due diligence to really see, okay, well, who's missing or what hasn't been considered or how could someone else in a different situation interact with the space? So I'm glad that you're still advocating for all that and helping to raise awareness for it.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, since our son was born and we started to kind of get to know of his disabilities as time went by, as the initial years went by, we started to get more and more immersed in the disability field. So for about 7 years, I was also on the the state advisory panel for special education in the state of Georgia, which advised the director of special needs on the special ed on the unmet needs of children with disabilities. And for 1 year, I was chair. And it really opened my eyes so much on the inequities in our schools, you know, when we're looking at the students with disabilities. First of all, there's so much of this whole thing of disproportionality, where, first of all, you know, students are disciplined more, those students who have disabilities. And then there's a double whammy where if the students of color who have disabilities are disciplined much, much, much more. So that's the disproportion we are talking about. And even when you're looking at the spaces in our schools itself, right? So I'll give you a quick example about. So in my son's, one of his first primary schools, elementary schools. Now, he's been through about, I think, 5 different elementary schools. And that's another thing, you know, they keep bouncing kids with disabilities around. And that itself is a thing of equity. But in one of his schools, I think he went there at age 6. And at least for the next 10 years, and he was there just for 1 year. And at least for 10 years, we had, you know, kids in the community, whenever we were out in the community, come up to him and say hello. And we never really knew what was happening, but they were all from the same school. And then we realized that it was because of the architecture of the school, the physical space of the school, of the way we realized that the primary means of circulation of the school was a series of ramps and not the stairs. And it was just a 3- or 4-story school, which meant that all of these kids had to be in the same public space, right, of the ramp. So that gave my son a lot of visibility and made him feel included. And I keep talking about this because it is such a personal, I mean, it's a personal example, right? And the power of well-designed spaces really hit home. And this school was, you know, otherwise it was not really like so-called high design or whatever, but it made a difference in my son's life. So that's something which we keep talking about, my wife and I. And of course, his teachers are great. And that's another big factor. But compared to that, the very next school he went to, it was, you know, the special ed classrooms are completely segregated from the rest of the school. I mean, the rest of the classrooms, they were in a corner and they had a separate entrance too. So, you know, it's like there is an entrance. Of course, we could go through the main entrance, but it's more convenient, right, go through that. So it becomes like you're unwittingly creating habits of segregation. So that's the kind of thing which I talk about in schools, which can really make such a big difference. I'm talking about the programming of spaces and the creation of spaces, which can make a huge difference in creating equity for kids with disabilities.
Yeah, that's such a powerful example. And I'm imagining kind of the school with the ramps where it's really equitable access space for everyone to be able to use the same path and not have to go through the back door or be separated from other people. That's really interesting and powerful.
Another thing which I keep talking about is how, Nikita, these kids who have been exposed to kids with disabilities, right? Their mm-hmm. peers who are not like them.
Right.
They are much, much more grounded. I mean, they develop more empathy for mm-hmm. people who are not like them. And who knows, in 20 or 30 years, they may be in positions of policy making, which where they'll be making policies which affect my son's life. Yeah, so we have to look at it that, you know, it's a two-way street there.
Yeah.
And so we all benefit from being exposed to people with disabilities.
Right. So personal story. So the schools that I went to had populations of kids with disabilities. And so, you know, in elementary school, I was a vision patrol. So I would walk some of the blind students to and from the bus. And then in high school, I played basketball and we had some of our basketball managers were actually girls who were in wheelchairs and had muscular dystrophy and all that sort of thing. But I didn't realize that not everyone kind of had access and friends who had physical disabilities. And so you saying that, you know, people who have access, like, oh, right, that was something that was somewhat unique. And I remember our basketball managers, some of them were nonverbal, but our coach would give them the bell to shake so that we would have to then go run. So we'd have to go like run the ladders when we were training. And so there are some days where we're like, hold on, don't give her the bell yet. We're not ready. Don't make us run just yet. Thank you. But then, you know, they were excited to be involved and they're at all our games. So yeah, that's actually a really good point. I hadn't thought about the fact that access and really just seeing people who have different disabilities to also demystify some of the fear that comes along with interacting with people who have different disabilities. And that's interesting.
Yeah, it is. I mean, and a couple of other things, you know, when you're immersed in the field of or world of disabilities, you start to kind of, you start to bat for people with disabilities. You know, you right. see them from at positions of weakness. And I'll give you another quick example of how, you know, whenever I see in our shopping, you know, strip malls and all of that, you have these, sometimes, many a time, you have the accessible parking spaces, which are clogged up by shopping carts.
Yeah.
Which makes it unusable. And I get so mad about that.
Yes. Yes.
And sometimes when I see people doing that, I go up to them and say, no, please take it away. I have a kid who has disability and I cannot use this space.
Right. And particularly when people try to either park in the access aisle or try to do something where they're blocking the access aisle, thinking that the access aisle is just extra space when it makes the space usable with like it's a whole. Yeah.
Oh. Yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Another interesting point about, you know, since I'm in the field of sustainability and accessibility, you know, sustainability, of course, we are trying to make our spaces as, less resource intensive and small as possible, etc. Size matters, of course, in talking about decarbonization and all that. But then people with disabilities, you know, we definitely require a lot more space than so there's an inherent contradiction there, but these are things which we need to kind of talk about more.
Yeah,
because another thing is is an interesting thing in my house. Our garage is full of we have to when we have a person with this development disability as my son who. Needs 100% care with or help with the everyday daily activity. Of course, he crawls, but otherwise he's non-verbal and he uses a wheelchair, etc. and needs to be fed and changed. We have to plan for redundancy, right? And that's resilience. I mean, in cases wheelchair breaks down, we have another wheelchair in the garage. we don't want to give it up. So our garage is full of, full of his wheels. So that's something which so redundancy is part of the resiliency thing, which I realized. Yeah.
Amazing.
Yeah.
Is there anything else you want to touch on before we wrap up?
A couple of things. So when we are talking about design for disability, you know, we always have to look at designing for the fringes, for the edges, for the margins, and the edge conditions. And when we do that, then everyone benefits. But sometimes we end up designing for the average person, right? Or the average, for the great mean, which where most people kind of exist, right? And that really doesn't work for anyone, actually. So yeah, I think that's an important point which we sometimes keep forget. So for instance, you know, you have the cliche of the curb cut, right? Which of course benefits the wheelchair user as well as the young parent with a stroller, that sort of thing. So it's an edge condition where everyone benefits. That's something which we need to think about, I think. Yeah. Another quick thing which I've been thinking about lately, and it's surprising how some things from way back come back, you know, into your thoughts. But when my son was just born, and I think in the second or third day in the NICU, so we got a report from the doctor, and it said something about failure to thrive, right? And that is, you know, that he would not grow as much and blah, blah, blah. So, but that was such a clinical and cold medical term, like failure to thrive. And I'm thinking, what's the opposite of that? So we really, I think we need to make our spaces where everyone can thrive and not just grow, but flourish. So that's something which, and people of all abilities, I think. And that I think is important for architects to consider, where how can we make our spaces where everyone can thrive? That's because it's the very, very opposite of what I encountered.
Thank you so much for listening. Links to amazing resources can be found in the episode's show notes. Special thanks to Sarah Gilberg for allowing me to use snippets of her song Fireflies from her debut album, Other People's Secrets, which, by the way, is available wherever music is sold. If you haven't already, be sure to subscribe to the show. And now that Tangible Remnants is part of the Gable Media Network, you can listen and subscribe to all network partner content at gablemedia.com. That's gablemedia.com. Until next time. Remember that historic preservation is a present conversation with our past about our future. We don't inherit the earth from our parents, but we borrow it from our children. So let's make sure we're telling our inclusive history.
I saw the first fireflies of summer. And right then, I thought of you. Oh, I could see us catching them and setting them free. Honey, that's what you do. That's what you do to me.
From historic homes to modern architecture, brick is one of the most popular building materials around the world.
How to allow the house to bridge the gap between the history of the site, the approachability of this kind of architecture in this kind of neighborhood, and this sort of nostalgia of materiality for the client's past, right? And brick really started to provide an answer for that.
Hi, I'm Doug Pat, and this is Design Vault. There aren't many materials that easily blend with any style and context, but brick does just that. I've seen some extraordinary work with brick. So when Glengarry approached me about hosting this podcast, I couldn't say no.
Typically, Tudor-style houses from outside are just stunningly gorgeous piece of structure. And when you go in, it's just sad.
Yeah.
Dark. And that is not going to happen with my approach to design.
I speak with industry leaders and share inspiring stories behind their work and ingenious design.
You'll see brick that's fashioned into basket weave patterns, sawtooth patterns. What's known in England as diapering.
Doesn't sound like you knew them per se, right? They found you through relationships that you had with other.
Well, wait, Doug, there's more.
Okay.
We'll go behind the scenes to understand process and even the inspiration that sparked the design.
You know, I think we were inspired by all the factory buildings in Dumbo. I mean, that is the kind of period of significance, that early American factory building.
Design Vault by Glengarry. Visit glengarry.com/design-vault or search for Design Vault wherever you get your podcasts and subscribe now to stretch your imagination.